let's look at the themes of this second screen. Some really interesting themes of justice in the environment. I'm going to put that on the hold because I'm going to explore those in our last class period tomorrow. Lectionary scriptural paraphrases, worship in the arts. I did start off with that one hymn, When the Morning Stars Together, and there are other hymns. This seems to be a particular emphasis of this kind of stream. The idea, I think, behind it is recognizing that the arts, including music, but more broadly, have almost a sacramental value. I didn't say they were a sacrament, but they have the potential of being a means of grace to people in how they communicate beyond fact, beyond narrative discourse, truth. When you walk into a cathedral in Europe, you can't help but be overwhelmed by the beauty of the windows. You can't help but be overwhelmed by the nature of that space. And even if that's not the space of your congregation, it says something theologically about those who gathered there. One particular aesthetician, her name is Susan Longer, she has a description of each kind of art form. And the one she calls for architecture is called ethnic domain. That it says something very specifically about the ethnicity, in the broadest cultural sense, of those who built and use that space. Yours does too. They don't all have to be the same. Sometimes we have to operate in spaces where the cultural ethnic domain has changed, but we're stuck with another architecture that said another kind of ethnic domain. You know what I mean? It's hard to get around. For example, let's say you have a very much a cathedral-like, where the pulpit, the choir are very separated from the people. But your kind of worship needs more of an immediate kind of contact. You have to work very hard in that. So pastors will come down from the pulpit and they'll speak to the people, or you might move the choir around in some other dimension or whatever. Then when you design your space, sometimes we forget that the congregation is part of that ethnic domain. So if we aren't careful, we design a space that doesn't allow the people's voice to be heard. And therefore, you've lost part of one of your dialogue partners. All the action is not up front. You know that. But if you've got to work with acousticians and with sound people, and sometimes fight your way, because they want to sell you easily prepackaged sound system, they can make the most money with the least effort. The kind of space you want may be the space that builds community. That means people have to hear themselves sing. And furthermore, maybe they need to see each other, not just what's up front. That's a very different kind of space. Music is involved in those kind of decisions. Inclusive language is a really major thrust here, both for deity and humanity. Most hymns that are written in the last, especially 20 to 25 years, make it an integral part of their writing and how they address deity and humanity in inclusive terms. This is not absent from other streams, but it's almost a sine qua non of this particular stream. That is a theological statement about priorities in the stream. It reflects a certain kind of piety. Whether one is comfortable at one end of the stream or the other with that particular one idea, I understand. But I think the danger is some people want to reduce this to a political issue. It is as much a theological statement as any other kinds of theological statements we encounter. One of the difficulties for a new hymn writer that wants to write in this particular style is not to write like Isaac Watts wrote, with these and thous and those. And so a lot of people will write in the old way until they get a good hymn writer who they kind of nurtures them and say, oh, you know, what about how we talk today? I love Isaac Watts. Not Charles West, I want to give them up, but you have a voice for today. How will that sound? Lectionary themes, of course, are very, there's several hymn writers, Gracia Grandal, Tom Trober, can see his face, Lutheran, now you see C. He'll come to me in just a minute. I have a number of these senior moments. But they look at all the lectionary texts and make sure there's a hymn for those. And whether or not they're all contained in a hymnal, they are available through copyright licenses in their collections. So you could have a hymn to support the primary text of the day. And a lot of congregations appreciate that. Scriptural paraphrases are also very important. For example, the Canticles, one of my favorites is the Mary song. Timothy W. Smith did one back around 1968 or 70. Tell out my soul the greatness of the Lord. And it, rather than start off with the usual translation from the Latin, my soul magnifies the Lord, this is an exuberant young lady. Tell out my soul the greatness of the Lord. And Dudley Smith was inspired by the New English Bible translation that sets it out that way in its, as poetry when you have one of the canticles. And so it's a great paraphrase. I mentioned worship and the arts. And then the sacraments also get quite a bit of emphasis. So let's look at a few examples. This is one that should be in a lot of your hymnals. Christ is alive, let Christians sing. Let's sing just a little bit, a hymn written for Easter, but I'll tell you the context in just a minute. The 60s were an interesting time to be alive. I was in Chicago for a good part of those, and it was a decade of assassinations. Two Kennedy brothers, Malcolm X, and of course Martin Luther King Jr. 10 days before Christmas Day in 1968, Martin Luther King was assassinated. And it was a shot heard around the world. Brian Wren, a minister at that time in the UK in the United Reformed Church, heard that shot. And he said, I just can't respond this Easter Sunday like nothing's happened. How can I bring this to my congregation? You know, he happens to be a gifted hymn writer, which was a really, really helpful thing to have. And so this hymn comes out of that experience. Yet, sometimes the strength of hymns is in not how you, especially in this style, is not how you label it. So you're not going to find Martin Luther King Jr. listed in the hymn. But you're going to find glimpses of the social context out of which he comes. And I don't want to stop singing Christ's Lord is Risen Today by Charles Wesley, but I think it's good for us to realize that the resurrection was not a past event. The acclamations say what? Christ has died. Christ is risen. Christ will come again. Our Christmas hymns and our Easter hymns don't say Christ was born yesterday. Christ is born today. These are events because of anamnesis that we experience as if they happened to us directly, which they do, because God's sense of time is much different than ours. So let's follow it through and see how he picks up on that. The second stanza.
Christ is alive.
Just for distant years in Palestine. One of the troubles of singing only the familiar Christmas carols or only the familiar Easter songs is we tend to treat these events, the incarnation, the resurrection, as historical only, when they have to keep happening every 7 days in the life of the church. And so just to stress that point a little further, not thrown too far.
Thank you.
pushing us towards something. We're not quite sure, but I haven't seen this in an Easter hymn before. Untouched, unmoved by human pains, but in the midst of our life. I thought this was, Christ the Lord is risen today, hallelujah. Forget all that other stuff. Pain's gone. Well, it's not gone. But we know there's hope. Okay, then he gets really serious down here. You don't have to read too far to figure out the social context. Strong.
It is.
In other words, we crucify him by our isms, by our racism, by our you name it. We continue to crucify Christ. He's changed it, and it's an equally effective phrase because it's very subtle. And lives though hope has died. Thank you very much. That's a later version. And you know where that phrase comes from? Hope has died. You know.
Lift every voice
and sing. There's a phrase in there that is almost exactly identical. So he actually references the African American, quote, national anthem. That is class, folks. This is the kind of thing this stream does that it's kind of hard to do in the others. I'm not saying that I love all of them, believe me. I love variety. But you have to admit that's pretty class. But people love to find that stuff out. You just can't do it on Sunday morning. You can write a newsletter article about it. You can talk to a Sunday school class about it. You can build little pockets of this kind of thing. But we just can't do it all on Sunday morning. And I tell you, people love it. People love it. I didn't realize. They just see it as a commodity. Well, whether it's on a screen or here, it's a commodity. And so we have to have ways to kind of bring it. Well, we got to bring it to a close here. Oh, okay, I guess he has one more stanza, too, that wraps it up, but I wanted to make sure and get that particular one in. Good. Now, let's look at another one here. This is Shirley Murray from New Zealand. And, well, you can, I'll just let Shirley speak for herself right now. Listen to it.
Who is my mother? Who is my brother? All those who gather round Jesus Christ. Spirit-blown people, born from the gospel, sit at the table round Jesus Christ.
Now she has the most incredible rhyme in the 20th century, the late 20th century I have ever seen. You'll see it right here. Whoever would have thought of rhyming stigmas with enigmas, but I mean, there it is.
Differently abled, differently labeled, wide in the circle around Jesus Christ. Crutches and stigmas, cultures, enigmas, all come together round Jesus Christ.
Okay, you tell me, what's her theology here? We haven't quite got through the whole thing, but what's her theology?
The wholeness of his love.
And what is the scriptural basis she starts from?
Who's my mother?
Who's my brother?
Of course, I think it's in all three synoptics. She starts by asking that question, but she's putting it in our kind of language. This point. And she's leaving it open. Differently abled can be all sorts of things. My wife's a school psychologist, and she deals day in and day out with differently abled people. And the context of their lives and working to mainstream them to help them have successful and fulfilling lives. Differently labeled. I would guess everyone in this room probably has had some kind of label given them. It's not particularly nice. And sometimes they tend to stick. You know, all sorts of kind of labels we give each other. And then she just labels herself crutches and stigmas, cultures and enigmas, what we do within cultural context. Now, it's often easy to spot this in another cultural situation. For example, right now we look at what's happening in Nigeria, the disappearance of the girls and selling them into prostitution or slavery or whatever it is. That's happening all over the world and even in our own country. Sometimes we spot those in the other cultures, but we forget the log in our own eye. How are we labeling people? Regretfully, we're so divided that political parties' names become labels that stigmatize people rather than being an expression of a perspective. And it's assumed if you're one way or the other, there's a problem with you, depending on which side of the fence is. So it's just human nature at its worst. It makes people believe in original sin, just by what we do. But she's saying there's room at the table, around. She keeps using this round word. You think of a table, not as a head table, mm-hmm. not like these, but as a round table where all sit together and see each other and face each other. Mm-hmm. Kind of like we'd like to have, you know, at home, but there's not enough space usually. Now this is the kind of thing you're not going to find written before 1950. This very much comes from our social location in general. And then she takes it in a little different direction here. I would guess that there are places in this hymn that almost all of you can find yourself. Try it with me if you like.
Love will relay us, cover our sins, and segregate us from Jesus Christ. Heavenly failings, human derailings, all are expected round Jesus Christ. Bound by one vision, met for one mission, we claim each other round Jesus Christ. Here is my mother, here is my brother, kindred in spirit through Jesus Christ.
Now, another thing about this is we sense a liturgical problem. You don't take a hymn, well, I don't think that you take a hymn like this that may be in your collection or whatever, you like it, and then all of a sudden without context, plop it on a screen or open a book to it. This needs to be set up by the sermon or a theme of the day or something, or at least maybe introduced and then unpacked in a sermon. So there's has to be a close connection here with what's going on. Otherwise, it's kind of, what? What'd you do that for? Why'd you put that guilt trip on me? Why did you, different people are going to find themselves and maybe not very flattered in this. This reminds me again, it challenges us when it's a natural tendency. If there's a tendency for us to think the first thing about worship is to make people feel good. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Now, I don't want people, I want people to leave more whole in the shalom sense. I want people to leave more whole and more at peace. But the journey toward that peace may not always be easy. Now, worship is not therapy. But if you've been through any therapy, I haven't personally been, but if you've been through some therapy, sometimes to get to the other end, there were some interesting stops along the way where you had to discover things about yourself. Again, I don't think worship is therapy, but on the other hand, parts of our story are really pretty gruesome. Parts of our story as a church are not flattering. And I'm not sure that we attract people to us if we're in denial about those. No, I wouldn't want to sing this kind of hymn three times in one service, or maybe even three Sundays in one month. Mm-hmm. But I would like to have it in there to remind us that of who we are. This is like a mirror placed in front of us. But it's a mirror with hope. It's a mirror with hope. Love will relay us. Let me stop just a minute, and I know I live in my own different kind of world with in teaching and stuff. I am in a lot of congregations, but let me ask the question this way: what kind of obstacles would you have in introducing this hymn in your congregation? And I'm quite aware that there's many. Yes.
I get it in my cultural context class. You know, we're in a monocultural community. Why do we need to talk about this?
It's a little bit like the argument made for not putting in handicap access. We don't have any of those people here. You see the problem.
Yeah. We'll never.
That's not a congregation that looks and says, what do we want to be in 25 years? And if we continue, you know, monoculturalism in of itself is not everyone's going to be able to be a UN church. But to say that's my intended vision for the next 25 years is another problem. Mm-hmm. Especially if you live where I live, and you live in this state, and you live in California, and quite a lot of you of them in between. It means that we're going to, in my case, it would mean that congregations are going to become little sectarian, ethnic sectarian groups. Gated communities. I don't find much basis for that. So it's a tricky one. But I think that's certainly the case. And you're dealing with dynamite here.
Mm-hmm.
But you didn't ask me to come here just to make you happy, did you? I have some other things that are...
Well, it sounds to me like you're speaking the truth and love with hope at the end, but in a way that our culture won't hear the truth.
I like that truth and love idea. I think that gives me a really nice handle on this. I ask these questions for my own sake. But it's, you know, where would Shirley get if she hadn't started off with that biblical passage? Mm-hmm. It then becomes a political diatribe.
That's right.
Yeah.
Or a PC thing. Mm-hmm.
Well, then she wraps it up. Here is my mother. Here is my brother. Kindred and spirit. So she wraps it all back home. Mm-hmm. Having said all that in and then you say, yeah, that's right.
She's class.
She is class. I think it also might be helpful to remind, if we're teaching people about a hymn like this, it might be helpful to remind people that even in New Zealand and Australia, they have their own issues with Indigenous peoples and the way that they've been treated. And so to say that it's not just us, it's a common problem.
She's got it. And that may be a great place to start. And you're exactly right. What's your name?
Ellen.
You're exactly right. She's very aware of those situations in her own, and that's a great place to start. And then all of a sudden, as you turn the mirror there, turn it around.
Yeah.
And what would be our analogous situation? There's plenty of logs and things and eyes to go around. Well, it's something to consider. Now, I'll throw one more idea out. Who introduces this and how it's introduced will also make a difference. Mm-hmm. And I used this once as a guest in a church on a retreat with young people. And they were immediately forthcoming. Mm-hmm. Immediately forthcoming. And I hadn't even planned on it. It was just part of a retreat. And we had several experiences and songs. And I said, what shall we sing for the people when we go back tomorrow? Number one choice. Mm-hmm. And so people receive that much differently coming from young people. Prepared for with a couple of testimonies from the young people themselves. All these things, it's not just, I'm going to throw a song at you and it's going to speak. All these things have to come together. And this is why our job is so fun. It's not a template to be plugged in. We got so many variables. And no, we're not going to bat 100% in the terms of choosing the right song or introducing it the right way, always. And we're never going to bat 100%, probably, for the whole congregation to stand up in unison applaud. But, you know, with truth and love, I'm really weary at this part of my life trying to keep that negative 5% happy at the expense of the other 95%. Mm-hmm. I will love you. I will go out to lunch with you. I will talk with you. But you know, we're just going to go ahead sometimes. I don't know. It's tough. It's tough. I love that 100%. I really do. My wife knows that I'll stay awake at night if one student didn't like my course. But, you know, we can't let that paralyze us for the vision of church. So are you starting to get a little sense of the prophetic dimension of this stream? Oh, let's go to Ruth Duck. Oh, by the way, a lot more women hymn writers show up all of a sudden at the end of the 20th century. And so that makes a really interesting one. Okay, this is equally a challenge. Talk about things we don't talk about in church. Listen.
Sacred the body God has created, temple of spirit that dwells deep inside. Cherish each person, nurture creation, treat flesh as holy, that love may abide.
Now, I don't know about you, when I grew up, we just didn't talk about those things. The body, the spirit. We were very Greek. You know, we had it all divided up. And the only time body was mentioned was when they were warning us teenagers about you know what. And otherwise it was when I had my first dance group at a church, Baptist church in 1970s, which was a fairly radical thing to do in Louisville, Kentucky then. One of the big concerns was covering those bodies up. We wanted those women to appear androgynous as much as possible. We didn't want them to know that they had, you can figure it out. And so we respected that, you know, we respected that, but it was just a lot of fear. At the same time, I realized in working with that group, not as the leader, but as a musician, that there are kinesthetic learners, and we've never given them a place in Protestant worship. You know, people that learn through feeling. It's like they all, a gigantic Montessori school. You know, for people that learn through a broader range of empirical data. And why not? So our texts were biblical based. We designed an outfit that we felt like could draw attention away from and toward the things we wanted to do. All sorts of things that we did, and I think over time that really, you know, won over the vast majority of the congregation. But we had to do a lot of serious thinking. But we didn't have that hymn at this time in the 70s. I couldn't point to this hymn and say that.
Bodies are varied, made in all sizes, pale, full of color, both fragile and strong. Only the difference, gift of the Maker, so let us honor each story and song.
Isn't it nice to know that if you're just slightly overweight, that you're accepted? Yeah. Isn't it nice to know that the 85-year-old that comes in with a cane in his or her fragility is still part of the big body? Now, Ruth just retired from Methodist Seminary in Chicago, Garrity Evangelical Seminary. And, you know, for her, underlying this word is always the body of Christ, the individual bodies that make up the body, theologically. So it's not just a description of blondes are acceptable and brunettes and bald. It's a little bit more than that. Now, she's leading us towards something. I told you about the third stanza. You remember the third stanza in Christ is Alive, and we start to move toward the insults, rift, and war. And what was the last one we just did? Shirley's hymn. We watched the third stanza.
Love respects persons, bodies, and boundaries. loves does not pattern, neglect, or abuse. Love touches gently, never coercing. Love leaves each of the other with power to choose.
I will lay odds that there are people who just will not be able to sing this. Mm-hmm. When have you heard a sermon that comes close to what is a big elephant in the room? So a poet has a way of saying these things, a skilled poet that opens up the conversation. Now, let's go back to the practical piece. This may not be introduced on Sunday morning. This may be introduced with a special group. And it may find a home in that group, and eventually, as a process of healing, may be taken to the whole congregation. I think it means it's still a viable part of our potential canon, but it's there. Can you imagine, some of you are preaching ministers, and boy, how do I approach this topic? How do I approach this topic? I don't know. But there are times in the life of the church when I want to leave it to the witness of people who are very close to it and the poets. Of course, undergirded by scripture. Sometimes I think we forget what the poets can help do for us. Like I say, every once in a while you run across a hymn or a stanza in a hymn where you just have to let the community carry on for you because you can't sing it. Yes, sir.
This kind of seems to me like a great wedding song.
Ooh.
For a couple, but then also for the church. Maybe a way to integrate.
Wow.
Without getting into the theological aspects of the commentary.
Hadn't thought of it from that angle. But. This opens up the whole theology of weddings too, which is very interesting as well. So, interesting idea. Join me if you like.
Holy of holies, God ever loving, make us your temples in well we do. May we be careful, tender and caring. So may our bodies give honor to you.
So she really seals it with several biblical images in that last stanza. Very essential. Hymns that address strong justice and social issues easily slip the diatribe without a strong scriptural foundation. So just a little... A little word there as you look at your own. Okay, so just before we break, let's go to, now not all hymns are this poignant as these four I'm showing you here that are written in the last, but this is an example of a whole different kind of writing. One of the things I like to use as an example is a bishop of the United Methodist Church was introducing a Spanish language United Methodist hymn. His wife was the editor back in 1996. And he made a statement that was just awesome. And really, it set me on the course for this book in many ways. Each generation needs to add its stanza to the great hymn of the church. Each generation needs to add its stanza to the great hymn of the church. And I'm not going to let go of the song of the past. I love to unpack Wesley and Watts. And if we had another 12 hours, I would do that. be glad to do that. But at this point, what does our stanza look like? It is the most incredible stanza the church has ever seen in terms of its diversity and richness. Partly because of who we are in dissemination and our knowledge of each other in the world. Well, I say it's potentially the most. We can shut it off and limit it. You all are hymnal editors. You can get, box it in, or little by little, over years, you can push the water up the banks and make room for more. make room for more. So not all of them are this poignant, but I want to do one that is. Oh, yes, sir.
I would have an inner conflict with using a hymn like this that is so apt to open up old wounds without some type of plan of dealing with
it. You are exactly right. Again, you're dealing with dynamite here. And so as I suggested, I'm not sure that at least initially this is the place in the primary worship service.
You've hit it on the head.
For me, I have used this hymn in public worship before, a very carefully constructed service. But I have sent the text of this hymn to someone who's confided in me as a pastoral poem. And the conversation started there as this hymn. Mary Louise Bringle is a Presbyterian hymn writer, is in North Carolina. And this one, we're starting to get personal. This is 2003, so we're talking about our century now. And one of the things that the church deals with now that it never dealt with before is the longevity of life and Alzheimer's and dementia, those kind of things. And so my guess is that for many of you, I'll start by singing this. You join in as you like, but if you have to drop out, I'll understand.
When memory fades and recognition falters, when eyes we love grow dim and minds confused, speak to our souls a love that never alters. Speak to our hearts by pain and fear abused. O God of life and healing peace, empower us with patient courage by your grace infused. As illness grows and youthful strength diminish, in weary arms which work their earnest will, your aging servants labor now to finish their earthly tasks as fits your mercy's will. We grieve their waking, yet rejoice believing your arms unweary shall uphold us still. Within your Spirit goodness is unfading, the past and future mingle into one. All joys remain, a shadow light pervading, no value deep will ever be undone. Your mind enfolds all my life asks and offerings. Held in your heart, our deathless life is one.
You can hear a lot of sermons at services of death and resurrection. Resurrection, as they're called, the United Methodist Church, and never touch that hymn.
Mm-hmm.
And it's theological. Yeah. Doesn't the Spirit move marvelously among creative people? Theologically informed creative people with poets. It's just incredible. Now, Mel Bringle, she chose a well-known tune. This isn't the time to teach a new tune. And a tune that has a certain weight to it that fit the ethos of the text. She's addressing this as much to the caregivers as to those, of course, who've passed away. And then, I only pick people up here that are my friends, and so I know almost all these people. That's what I get to do, hang around hymn writers. But anyway, I asked her what her most her favorite phrase was, or her favorite hymn, or what she was most proud of, or pleased that she had written. It just seemed to really grasp her most. And it was this phrase right here. Can you imagine what good news that could be for someone who's a caregiver? I know enough getting to the age where I have some older friends, and not only these things happen, but certain, sometimes less desirable aspects of our personality become more pronounced. The angry side or the frustrated side, it all takes turns in various directions. And can you keep that in perspective? And then the way she brings it back with this resurrection kind of feeling here at the end, she offers hope. It's just a masterpiece.
Mm-hmm. I have a problem using a well-known used melody.
Yeah, it has to be.
For such a good writing of word and borrowing a melody, I just cannot help to go back to the old song.
Sure. Your point is well taken. And you know, again, everything is culturally conditioned. I think that she and many others would see a consonance in this case between "Be Still My Soul," "The Lord is on my side," and this particular expression. So I think in this case there is a consonance between those texts. And this actually takes it to a very specific situation where "Be Still My Soul" works. But melodies carry connotations with them.
Yes.
For example, just because it fits, you don't want to say, "Oh, God, our help in ages past, our shadow to her from the stormy blast, and our eternal home, and our eternal home, and our eternal home." We! Now, that I've trivialized what you're saying, but I think your point is well taken. Again, I didn't tell you your job was easy, but it is full of creative possibilities. The thing about your statement is, what is appropriate may vary from community to community. But it's time for a break.